What would you say you've learned in the past 4 years about the city and the challenges that face somebody who's at the helm?
Well, I have to tell you that I knew this was going to be a hard job. I didn't quite know how hard it would be. I mean, I came in at a time when we hadn't quite reached the end of the recession. So literally within the first month, I was $58 million in deficit. And so that was extraordinary. And then within a year, Judge Henderson would order that thousands of prisoners be released, and many of them ended up in Oakland. And so the challenges facing the city, plus when you add the ending of redevelopment by Jerry Brown before the end of the year, were pretty amazing. We were going from crisis to crisis to crisis, not of our creation, but they were mine to deal with. And it taught me quite a lot. It taught me one of the things that I most value of that first month is I literally sat down with all of the unions and I said, look, what we've been doing is just cutting. We've almost cut, at that time, 700 city workers. We'd had 5,000 workers. We would cut 700. And I said, so with this kind of deficit, I had frozen hiring. As soon as I was elected, I asked the Dellums administration to freeze hiring because I had a sense that we were probably in trouble. And I said, we would have to lay off another 200 to 300 people, including police officers. Do we really want to do that? Would you consider taking furloughs? And they did. And so we closed down a day a month for the first 2 years and the time between Christmas and New Year's. And the city workers gave back 9% of their pay for 2 years to save the jobs of other employees and to save city services. So I always thank the city workers for doing that. They didn't have to do that. And I learned how generous our employees could be. And over the years, I would meet employees who lost their homes during those 2 years and who had so many other sacrifices and feel unappreciated. So I often start my stories like this about that. And I learned that city people would step up too, that people have started adopting parks, et cetera, et cetera. And that there's this sense that we're in this together. And, you know, now the city is amazingly turned around. A recent poll showed, maybe for the first time since Elihu Harris has been mayor, that more people think the city's going in the right direction than in the wrong direction. Now, there's still a lot of people who think the city's going in the wrong direction. But this change in attitude and sort of this resiliency and what you see in the city taught me the second thing, is that we're an amazingly resilient city. We're amazingly a progressive city, and we're willing to do new things. Personally, on a personal level, learning what the boundaries of what a mayor can do and learning how to lead as a mayor who has some executive authority but not full executive authority, and that how to work with a council that is often divided and split. I think I've learned a little bit about that. And I've also learned a lot about the whole city, because people pay attention to you in a different way when you're mayor. I have made a real attempt to be unlike some of the previous mayors. I've made a real attempt to be in every neighborhood, every church, every school, to try to be the mayor of the whole city. And that's a very tough thing to do when the city is sometimes polarized on some key issues.
And such a diverse city with so many different demographics,
exactly,
that have very different needs. What, and you say that there have been some specific challenges, some specific divisions. What can you sort of pinpoint as some of the specific divisions that are facing the city, the divisions of how to govern, of how to go forward, that you think are going to be a challenge in the next 4 years?
Yeah, I've inherited, it's sort of funny, I'm beginning to close out the debates with this statement, basically. If you're going to blame me for everything that's been wrong for the last 10 years, you have to give me some credit for the things that have gone well in the last three. And there are some long-standing issues in the city that I think we've really taken on. And not only have I had to take on tough things that were handed to me, but I've taken on some tough things that have been there for quite a while. So I'll give you an example of two that I think were particularly transformational for the city. One is I'm really the first mayor to sit down with both the federal judge and the federal monitor of the police department. You may remember that in the last election, my opponent got over $1 million from the prison guards and police officers unions against myself as a candidate. And I was really the first mayor, I think, elected without the support of the police officers union. They've been a very powerful force. And do not get me wrong, I respect our police officers, and I think I've actually worked harder with them than directly with them than probably any mayor. But I did know that we had been stuck on the federal mandates and oversight, and that if I didn't make a change, it was very likely that the police department would be taken over by the federal court, that they had been somewhat stuck. And when I became mayor, about half of the original 50 items that the federal court was expecting progress on were still there. And right now we're down to 5. I worked really hard and was the first mayor to meet directly with the monitor pretty much on a monthly basis, or to talk to him at least on a monthly basis, and to take on some of the tough issues of reform. So I'll give you an example. A lot of media called me in the last month about Ferguson, and they wanted to know about the badge cameras. And I smiled and said, you know, we were the first big city in America to totally convert to the badge cameras. And in fact, one of my opponents talks about, oh, those $2 million unspent technology money. And that was because that was for car cameras. And I stopped that program, and then we switched the money eventually over to badge cameras, because talking to the monitor and talking about the complaints against the police, I was saying, so what can we do to make sure that people feel more comfortable about police? And we talked about several things. He said, you know, these new badge cameras. And he bet me, and he was right. He said, I bet you with the badge cameras, your complaints against police would go down significantly. And they have. They've gone down more than half. Partly because in many times, the badge cameras are actually exonerating the police, because I think it was just standard, say, oh, police brutality as a defense. And then secondly, I think when you're wearing a badge camera, you know that your conduct is on the record. And so that was very critical, and it's become very serious. Like during the one Occupy demonstration where I called an independent investigator, some officers did not turn their cameras on. That is a very serious offense today in the Oakland Police Department. So I took on some things head on, met weekly or talked weekly with the monitor, and then we also just reorganized the police. We reorganized the police for the first time to really have geographic accountability. So if you were to call and say, I called the police and they never came, I can literally go down to the zone. I can check the 911 records and find out, why didn't we come? Why didn't we take it seriously? And I have to say, before I became mayor, I'd often hear from immigrants that, you know, that people would not come, or when they came, they didn't seem to have any feedback. And I'm sure the language was a barrier, but now that rarely happens. I think people understand that they're going to be held accountable for that geographic area. I have recruited the most diverse police force in the history of the city. So in the very beginning, when I talked about how the finances were horrible, one of the things that I was able to get was everybody to put in 8-9% of their pay for the furloughs. But the police can't take furloughs. They paid into their pension for the first time in history, and it began to shrunk the pie that the police and fire was taking. Because when I became mayor, 75% of the entire general fund was taken up by police and fire, and about another 16% goes to debt. So that left about 10% to run the entire rest of the city at that time. It's now more like 63-64%, so that's freed up some money. But it is also made sure that the slice of the pie is fair. And as I've grown the economy, I have invested in one academy after another. I've just authorized our 7th police academy, and that's after 4 years almost of no police academies. So all the young officers that have been hired since I've been mayor, over 50% of them are people of color for the first time in history. About 40% of them speak a second language, much like the city. And for the first time, we start out at least with 1 out of 5 women. We're graduating 1 out of 6. There's a slightly higher dropout rate with women. But it is absolutely the most diverse police force in the history of the city.
There was some struggle with changes of leadership in OPD, rapid changes in leadership that were happening. Do you see that as sort of being in the past, and kind of are you looking forward to a better working relationship with OPD and a more solid leadership?
I think that, first of all, if you remember, I came in, I inherited Ron Dollums' chief. And he was the first person I met with right after election. I actually had breakfast, I think, 2 days after the election, after I slept in. And I said, so we got 18 months to meet the federal mandate. You were hired by Ron Dellums. Do you plan to stay? Do you want to stay? And he said, oh, yes, I want to stay. If Don Proud had won, I'd be owned by the union, blah, 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 blah. I found out in a couple of weeks that he was applying in San Jose. So probably my first mistake was not doing a national search for a chief. But I was trying to weigh getting the federal mandate done quickly, was worried that if we changed leadership, it turns out I should have, because both Howard Jordan and now Sean Wendt have a much stronger dedication to complying with the federal mandate. And we've made a lot more progress under the both of them. So Anthony Batts quit the week of Occupy. Howard Jordan, who had been doing most of the federal compliance anyhow, was set in as interim. And I think he was the first chief actually to take on the OPOA. I asked for an independent investigation after Occupy. The Chief Frazier came in. He changed our policies and regulations. He conducted a training of all 600 officers. And we disciplined over 40 officers for the first time. And that, I think, sent a really strong message. And we have really actually had much better conduct by the department and handling of police demonstrations since then. So we made it, I think we tried to send a strong message. We tried to retrain people, give them a chance. And we've worked very hard to make sure that we handle demonstrations as constitutionally as possible. Even though there's a pretty violent anarchist segment that tries to take over a lot of the demonstrations in Oakland. But I've been pretty strong with the police. I said, I don't want you tear gassing a crowd of 200 people because a handful of anarchists are throwing rocks and bottles or breaking windows. We've got to find that balance. And it's not been easy for them. So I thank them, because I think they've got the methodologies down now that we can protect the private property of our small, vulnerable businesses downtown. At the same time, make arrests for people who have total disregard for the safety of people in Oakland and for our small businesses. I think Sean went through the national search process, and there are two very strong candidates, but the reason we chose Sean, and I was part of the decision-making, is because, one, he's got a very long and firm record of upholding discipline against officers when there's been misconduct. And secondly, I've been in city government for quite a while. He's the first chief I've seen that actually has sort of a team around him. He's not just the general at the top and no relationship. He has more women, more minorities in his top leadership group than any other chief I've seen in history. And I think it makes a real difference. And, I've had a chance to work with Sean. And he came in, when Howard Jordan quit because of health reasons and the stress of the job. It's a very stressful job. I asked Sean and I asked the team, are we ready? Should we delay the reorganization of the police department? And they said, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. We've been planning for it. We're ready for it. And I've watched them implement the reorganization into the five districts with really holding officers accountable and really holding them accountable also for getting out of their cars and to meet the neighborhood and to talk to the neighborhood and to really be responsive to the citizens in every part of the city. And I've watched them grow as a team and really work together as a team. And I'm impressed. So we've got a chief now has a 4-year contract, no matter who the mayor is, and who has a really good team, high percentage of Oakland residents, again, a higher percentage of women and minorities than I've ever seen.
Are you concerned? I know that there was some shuffling around of the PSOs, for example, in terms of distributing Measure Y money. Do you think that we don't have enough community policing? Would you like to see more?
One of the problems is under our contract, officers get to shift their, by seniority, get to shift their assignments every year. One of the things I'd like to discuss with the union in the upcoming year is making it two-year assignments, particularly for problem-solving officers, because you got to know the neighborhood. Now, so in some neighborhoods, you've got people who've been there for a long time. They like their beat. They're not moving. But for a lot of other, particularly, we just increase the number of sergeants dramatically in the Oakland Police Department to increase the what they call the span of command, that is the oversight. And that's one of the things the federal judge wants, want more oversight so you have less individual cowboys out there as police officers, is I think how they would describe it. And a lot of the PSOs end up being sergeants because they're some of the better officers in how they deal with the community and how they deal with
They have the diplomatic skills built into their job description.
Right, exactly. And so that's one of the problems this time. But now we have quite a few sergeants. We have a list. I'm hoping there'll be less turnover. But the other thing is, as I grow the police force, you also have to have more sergeants and lieutenants to oversee the growing police force. So there is a lot of tumbling right now, but it's because of a good reason, because of growth. We're also going to have the boomers, like in every other field, who are going to be retiring. And Oakland police officers pretty much quit at age 50 if they have a full pension, because they're still young enough to go work for another agency and, quite frankly, get a second pension. So that's a bigger issue, something I can't control. But we are looking at, well, maybe particularly for the senior officers, could I pay them more to stay, to make it worth their while to stay and not go and seek
And not lose
pension.
That experience.
Yes, and not lose that experience. So that is definitely something I'm looking at.
You mentioned Occupy, and obviously that was a huge and controversial moment in your first term. In terms of sort of lesson learned or things that you might do differently knowing what you know now, I mean, hindsight is obviously 20/20. Are there ways in which you would have dealt differently with Occupy, you know, if you could do it again?
I think if the whole city could do it again, we'd probably do it differently. I think the problem was it was a new and quick-moving phenomena, and I think depending on who you are, you had a totally different view of what was happening. I was struck, you know, I read a lot of polls in planning, and so I was looking at that at the time that was happening, about 70% of the people supported the Occupy movement, supported everything that was happening downtown, but they weren't downtown. They had no idea what was really happening. On the other hand, I run into people today who hate me because they're probably our version of Tea Partiers, and they're the 20% that never vote for any taxes and just want us to cut everything and only have police, right? And there is a small, probably 15-20% part of the population in Oakland that feels that way pretty consistently. No new taxes. They don't care what it's for, but they do want as many police as they can get. I was struck when I was asked this question the other day, so I'll tell you from the left and the right. So on one hand, there was a woman who basically said, "You're just stupid. You should never have let them be there to begin with." And I said, "Well, yeah, I am the mayor, but I'm not the whole government." And I said, at that time, I had both two council members in the encampment, and the council was seriously considering giving Occupy a permit. And so can I unilaterally close down the camp when there's not consensus? Because I think government's about consensus. Democracy is very hard. You need to sort of build consensus.
It's
very messy. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time down in the plaza talking to different groups. And I actually went to the march to support Occupy Wall Street. And I remember walking in that day. This is like the camp had just started the day before. And the group that was controlling the microphone at the plaza wasn't letting the group that was marching in favor of Occupy. And I knew, okay,
democracy inside the council and outside the council is equally messy.
I knew that there was going to be a problem. I did not know that a fairly small group of people would use the Occupy rule to take over the encampment and then not talk to the city. I mean, we tried to be collaborative. We thought, you know, at first I thought it would be a small protest and it would not go on forever for sure, right? But it was very clear within a week or so when someone fell out of a tree and they wouldn't let a paramedic in, that they tried to close off the whole camp and that they tried to fill it full of homeless people and other people and build barriers around the edges, that was taking over public space. So we gave them a notice and said, you know, we're giving you a 5-day notice. We're going to close down the camp. And then there was an incident where a mentally ill person was disruptive, and they hit him over the head with a 2x4. And then I said, okay, that's really it, guys. We're going to – and I saw the drug dealers moving in, predicted that we might have some issues, and we did have a shooting. If they couldn't control the camp, it's so not like New York. In New York, it was in a private space. There were literally union staff running the camp, and so that was well organized and it was open. And some very wealthy people, when there was a rape in the camp, they hired 25 security guards for the camp. That is so not what happened in Oakland, where you had a small group of people not letting anybody in. And I remember walking during the day and talking to some of the unions who were there and said, you got to choose here. You're either going to have to staff up and take over this camp so that there's some collaboration, or you guys need to leave. And so I spent the extra time trying to build consensus, and you know that is somewhat more my style. And then so people on the right thought, no, should never allow that, even though if I had done it, they could have turned around and then the consul could have ordered them a permit. I needed to try to see if we could get political consensus. I finally convinced the consul that we had to close it down. On the other hand, there are people from the left who, particularly those who were not downtown and didn't see what was happening. I think later, when people realized that a very small group of anarchists were running it, that people were not part of it. Because one of the questions that you asked me earlier was, did it leave a lasting impact on the Oakland movement? I think, unfortunately, it was too many outsiders. I think the young people, particularly from Oakland, people like my daughter, people who were doing long-time progressive politics way before what they considered the sort of showboating of these outside suburban kids, people who actually had been working around foreclosures, had really working on the environment, they left the camp pretty quickly. As soon as the vote went negative, and, you know, over, I think, 70% of the people voted for them to be nonviolent. Violent, and the anarchist group did not vote for that. And since you had a 90% constituency, after that point, pretty much all of the local activists left the Occupy grouping. A couple of unions still had their boost there, but they were having internal struggle, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that that if anything, Oakland has changed some of the outside suburban types who came in to save us. I think they've learned that some of the issues, gentrification, the issues of poverty, are much tougher than just taking over a plaza. I think that probably the straw that broke the camel's back for most Oaklanders, because now it's gone from 70% of Oaklanders supporting the Occupy movement to almost the same amount being opposed to the current group that identifies itself as Occupy, was when they broke the windows at the Obama headquarters during the election. And people are like, so what are you for, mm-hmm. right? Are you just against things? And I think particularly people are mad. Like the other night, a few of the Black Bloc people were trying to take over a Ferguson demonstration. It was really remarkable because my staff was marching with the group. All the West Oakland young people just left them. They tried to break the windows at the Danish bakery. Mm-hmm. And my staff said it was amazing. 10 young people they broke a window and they got right in front of the windows and started yelling at them, saying, you know, this is the only bakery that takes WIC and food stamps. Leave it alone, right? And then they literally split off in them, right? And so Occupy's left us some scars, but I think it's not hurt the local movements. I think the local movements sort of see them as they came and they went, but they're not about Oakland.
But there are some candidates who have adopted, I mean, in this race, who have adopted the Occupy mantle, in a sense. I mean, we have Einstein the dog, for one. I know that's a joke, and he's not really running. But there are some people who have sort of maybe associated Occupy with an opening up of the conversation and an opening up of the activism that then has gone on to things. And as you say, it was already there before Occupy in many cases, but has gone on to things like those who opposed Urban Shield, which you recently in the council basically said it will no longer have a home in the Oakland Marriott. So have you seen young people's activism energize the city in a time where things are changing?
I think it has, but I think it's not. They were the people who basically said, hey, we were there before them and we've been doing it for a long time. I mean, if you look at the progressive coalitions, let's say like Oakland Rising, so you've got the groups that have been working on the environment, you've got mm-hmm. the groups that have been working on getting jobs at the Army base, you've got the groups that have been been fighting, Just Cause and others that have been fighting, the Push-Up Tenets. They've been doing really concrete, progressive work that has been pushing the edge, that's more institutionalized. And it's, you know, that's the difference, I think, between sort of an anarchist thing where you're just tearing something down and where you're trying to build alternatives. And they all work to an extent with the government. That is, they work with me, and I've been working with them, and I've been trying to empower particularly young people in the movements, to recognizing their ideas and their demands, and to make really concrete change. So, I mean, Occupy, I mean, when you looked at the people who were arrested, and I'm not saying they're all from the suburbs, but huge numbers were, 80, and the ones are from Berkeley, I'm assuming were students, so who knows where they originally are from. But, you know, it was sort of shocking when I first saw the two arrest records and saw that most of these people were not from Oakland. And then particularly when the violent demonstrations happened, they arrived by BART, right? And then they trash our city. And I think we're very proud of our city, Oaklanders, and we don't like the idea of anybody in any name, whether it's revolution or whatever, trashing our city, because we've worked so hard to build it up. And then particularly when, you know, I have to say, when a suburban kid in a $200 jacket comes and lectures me about poor people, and I'm the mother, I had a mother who was an illiterate immigrant mom, and we lived way below the poverty rate, it does chafe us a little bit. And, you know, it's just sort of, I've been involved in the civil rights movement since I was a teenager. I've been associated with almost every progressive movement on the West Coast all my life. I still fight for immigrant rights and particularly for young people every day. And so we don't all have to agree in the movement, but we need to not harm the city, and we need to work together to make progress.
Absolutely. And I have just a couple more questions and then we're done, because you've given me so generously so much of your time. But I wanted to ask in terms of, first of all, about Urban Shield and your decision after 8 years to kind of say, no, you're not welcome at the Marriott, although they'll still be in Alameda County. What finally brought you around to make that decision?
Well, you know, the chief and I, it's not that we never will maybe ever host one again, but we've been the main host for, and so let's be clear. It's unfortunate it has that name, but, you know, a lot of the work, a lot of these conferences were actually sort of the result of a conversation that Barbara Lee and a couple others of us politicians say, like, can we really use, particularly since they put FEMA underneath the whole national security thing, we've been getting a lot of grants from FEMA because we've been like disaster central. This is October. This is the anniversary of Loma Prieta, the anniversary of the firestorm. And I remember Barbara Lee and I sitting in a bus during one of these very early, and we're like, so could we maybe do a earthquake evacuation instead scenario next year? And so we've been trying to get it to be a more well-rounded, because, you know,
not just about terrorism,
not just
about
terrorism,
but about disaster prep.
A chemical. So like this next year after that, it was about a chemical spill at the Port of Oakland. So we've been trying to get, so let me let you know that at these conferences, they don't just discuss military operations. They actually discuss a wide variety of interagency coming together. Because quite frankly, if we have an earthquake on the Hayward Fault, I want all the help we can get, right? Because we could lose up to 15,000 lives. We could lose a third of our rental housing. And so, but what we found is that they've had almost all their conferences in Oakland rather than in the region. And so that particular weekend, I think that was the weekend that we had a Hyrule conference, a concert with 23,000. We'd had Oakland Pride with about 40,000 visitors. It was a A's game. And we had Urban Shield, and it's just our place, we're exhausted, right? And we had so much overtime. Oakland is like the booming place to be. We're the home to so many festivals, and we're like having this on top of that. So we've asked the hotel to share the wealth a little bit and not to renew its contract for next year. But it doesn't mean that we never might have one. But the bottom line is that I think along all of this, just because there is the military aspect of it, that people think you can't have anything to do with it. The reality, and you know, is that some of these tools, like having cameras over the freeways, are really going to help us if the earthquake happens. We're going to see which roads are open, which way the I always talk about what happened during the firestorm, that the police officer and firefighter were leading people down the hill. Had they known that Charing Cross was blocked, they could have gone up to Grizzly Peak and everybody would have survived. So we have to have some balance in terms of it. And I know that there's often a very negative attitude towards government these days and a distrust of government. And I feel often in the campaign that people are talking about things that happened a while ago and not even willing to look at the things that have changed and are getting better.
And that's what something that I want to ask about. Oakland is changing, and it's changing rapidly. Is one of the challenges, you know, maintaining this very unique, sort of fierce, passionate Oaklandness, and at the same time trying to balance out with what has happened in San Francisco, which is basically a large amount of displacement, a lessening of the diversity, and a pricing out of people who help right now make Oakland what it is.
So I'm not going to promise you that I'm going to turn around capitalism, right? But I have worked pretty systematically to make sure that Oakland stays diverse. And what do I mean by that? Now, the San Francisco Guardian had this cover that I love, and I've been trying to get a cover of it so I can frame it. It basically says, is Oakland cooler than San Francisco? And the article is about housing. The reason that Oakland is so diverse and the reason that we're so cool is that we've always had affordable housing for all price ranges. And it's also so, like someone said, oh, we have the widest economic gap. And I said, yeah, because we have rich people and poor people. We haven't, like, if you only have rich people and upper middle class professionals like San Francisco is becoming, then you're not gonna have much of a gap. But Oakland actually has some of our home owned, grown young capitalists and older, most of the older families have moved to San Francisco, I have to tell you. But we have a wide range of fairly comfortable people, middle class professionals, working class people, and really poor people and immigrants. And unfortunately, because we're more affordable, I'm getting a higher percentage of the people just released from prison, right? And so we have this wide range. And so the things that I've done, particularly around housing, that's why most of the housing activists are supporting me, is that I have done five things, and we're going to do a few new things. So quickly, when Jerry threatened to take away redevelopment, we used the money we had left and made many new partnerships and non-traditional partnerships to build affordable housing. We've either taken housing that was so poor that no one could live in it and retrofitted it and built 1,700 new housing units in the last 3 years. Now, and while I've been mayor during my watch, that's more affordable housing that's been built under any other mayor, at least in recent times. I have no idea what happened in the 60s, but or what the numbers would have been. But we were very creative. We used both the Obama money for homeless vets, and we used market credits for senior housing. But that has slowed down the push out. Because, I mean, I think when you talk about gentrification, it could mean that you're improving the neighborhood or it could mean that you're pushing people out. And a lot of Oakland neighborhoods need to be improved. And so we just finished the West Oakland Civic Plan. So
this is why I use the term displacement, not gentrification,
because
it's such an umbrella term.
Absolutely. So I appreciate it. And I caught that you did that. But people in general ask me about gentrification. So we're not San Francisco. We have a lot more land. We're almost twice your area mass to begin with. And then we've had these areas that the city tore down many years ago. We have these empty lots.
Yeah.
And the redevelopments bought up a lot of them, and we're going to be selling those as we wind down redevelopment, and I'm going to use some of those to build affordable housing. So the second thing you have to do is just get more housing,
yeah,
right? And so I now have 11,000, and if the Coliseum deal goes through, 13,000 homes in the pipeline.
And those are focusing on areas like West and East Oakland, which are historically the center of poverty.
Yes, but also along the transit corridors, because this is a green plan, and that's where the new money will be. So as a council member, I fought for these priority zones under ABAG so that when state funding came, that the housing money should go there. And those are along our corridors and at our BART stations. And then as a mayor, I fought to make sure that a share of the cap and trade money, and that the small percentage of redevelopment that comes back to city, that a quarter of that goes to affordable housing. So of those 11,000 homes, I have 15%, enough money to make 15% of the affordable, and we're going to now do a affordable housing tax that would be put on all new housing. And with the cap and trade, my commitment is to make sure that 25% of all the new housing is also affordable, again, to slow down the displacement. We are also working on trying to build alternative kinds of housing. A lot of candidates have different schemes or whatever. So, for instance, I'm working right now with Elaine Brown, who used to be with the Black Panthers and works for Supervisor Carson, to build a cooperative housing unit near West Oakland BART for young men and women who've gotten out of prison so they can live in a cooperative way and have cooperative businesses. So we're looking at new and different things. We're looking particularly for seniors. A lot of my generation, I'm a boomer. We've done a lousy job on our pensions, right? A lot of my friends work for nonprofits their whole lives. They almost have nothing saved up. And I said, let's get you signed up for one of our senior affordable housing, because in 10 years, you'll move up the list and you'll have a place to live, because I'm worried that they're not going to have enough pension to support themselves. And so we've built a lot of senior housing in particular to try to protect the people who are already here. And one of my future goals, so I'll talk about that just briefly, is we're looking at programs that will benefit people who already live here, whose housing stock is declining. So working with the landlords, doing preventative and preemptive inspections of housing units to make sure that they maintain and stay in force. We're working at looking at possibly of giving short-term temporary rent assistance. Like, I have a very good friend who's lost her job, and she may not be able to pay her rent in the next few months, but I know she's going to get a job. But I don't want her to become homeless in interim. So maybe paying that little bit of gap between what she can pay and what her rent is cheaper than relocating her to a homeless a shelter with her children, right? So we're looking at sort of smart ways to intervene. And in terms of building new housing, I'm looking at which ways, maybe by giving the land or making deals with developers, that I can underwrite what we call workforce housing. These are people who don't make low enough income to get into public housing, but don't make enough money to buy the median house in Oakland. So I was at a church this Sunday, and this is one of my favorite stories now. I often say at churches is that we're working really hard to get people jobs at the Oakland Army Base, where longshoremen can make 50. It's a 50% local hire goal. We're expanding the base. There'll be new berths. There'll be new railroads. There'll be hundreds of new jobs for longshoremen, if not 1,000 new jobs. And so we've been saying, so I don't want to get your grandson a job at the Army Base. They become a longshoreman, but then they can't afford a house and they move out to Antioch. And the entire church started laughing. And I'm like, that was not that funny. And then a young man stood up and he said, I'm a longshoreman. I just bought a house in Antioch, but I'm still a member of this congregation. I'd like to move back. So those are some of the things that we're looking at. And I'm very proud. I think I have one of the best records of any mayor in history in terms of fighting for affordable housing, fighting for affordable housing funds, because I understand that's the heart of the city, that if the city's housing is not diverse, the city will not be diverse.
So now we have a lightning round, which is basically just a few personal questions. They're very silly.
When
you were little, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to work at the United Nations. I sort of think I met that goal because we speak 130 languages in Oakland.
There we go. Your first job?
My very first job was working in the school cafeteria before the free and reduced lunch program. you know, I was the only Chinese kid. My dad moved us from Oakland out to Livermore, and he died soon afterwards. And so I probably stood out. I think everyone knew that my mother was an immigrant who didn't speak English, was trying to run a restaurant all by herself, and that we were pretty poor. And so I think they meant it as a kindness, but all the poor kids got to work in the school cafeteria for an exchange for a free lunch, right? And, you know, I was actually very proud of trying to help my mom because I knew it was hard. I knew that she worked. She got way early in the morning and didn't come home until after 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And, you know, we grew our own vegetables and had roosters and whatever. You know, my mother was very, people ask like, why I'm so cheap, you know, and thrifty, as my family would say. And it's because I literally grew up with a mom who knew starving children in China. And you know, she was able to come over just after World War II in the first break of the Chinese Exclusion Act, where up to that point, where mothers and wives of U.S. citizens were not allowed to come and they were not allowed to become naturalized citizens.
Absolutely. That is quite a story around your first job. And then what is your favorite book?
My favorite what?
Book.
Oh, that's pretty hard.
You can pick two.
I can pick two. You know, one of my most earliest books that left impression on me was Helen Keller's book. And, you know, I thought I was going to be a teacher, a special ed teacher at one point. So that was after wanting to work for the
United Nations, you moved on to wanting to be a special ed teacher.
Special ed teacher. And I actually ran some special ed programs and worked at special ed camps. And when I became a school board member, that was one of the things I really. And it's because I think I associate with people who are different, right? And being people sort of say, sometimes I don't seem that friendly, and part of it's just Asian Americans. We don't look people at eye. We think it's rude to intrude, but I've learned now I say hi to everybody, and whether I know them or not, and you know, try to look people in the eye, because good Chinese girls don't look people in the eye. But, you know, I had a real sense of how it was to be different and to be treated different, and there's a certain kind of toughness. And what I loved about the Helen Keller book was that her amazing spirit. And being able to reach out and get out of her sort of world. And so, you know, for me, that was the same challenge. How do I get out of my own background where I was taught to be quiet and be a good Chinese girl? And, you know, I had an incident at Berkeley that sort of made me have to stand up for myself. And that became a habit afterwards. You know, it's sort of like you had to stand up for myself being the only Chinese kid. And, you know,
what happened? Can I ask what
having
happened?
Unkind things said to you. Well, I've told this story before and I had not remembered it until Cecily Burke interviewed me for San Francisco Chronicle Background. And I talked about how, you know, I went to Berkeley on scholarship and Berkeley, for a freshman those days, is pretty boring. All your classes were like free to 500 students, and you could just buy the Cliff Notes and pretty much not go to school and do well. And so I started becoming a student activist. So I was volunteering at West Oakland. That's where I first met Elaine Brown. I was in a school right next to a church where she was feeding kids. And I helped with the Great Boycott because you know, a lot of Valley kids, we went out and helped with the Great Harvest, et cetera, et cetera. So I was helping with the Great Boycott because the regents were buying more grapes just to spite the farm workers, and we were boycotting the school cafeteria. And I'd put up a leaflet. And if you were a Cal in the 60s, the whole place was plastered with leaflets, et cetera. And I put up the leaflet on our student activities door next to the office where I worked. And some cop, campus cop, gave me a ticket. I'm like, are you kidding me? Right? I was like, and, you know, I sort of got to say this because I'm like, Asian girl, you're like going to bully or harass me or what? The entire campus is like, you know, totally. And this is like our student building, right? And it was like right next to where I was working, coordinating community projects. And a week later, I was called into the dean's office. And they had my mother there, and she was crying. And basically, they were threatening my scholarship. And This was, now I have to say, this is when going to Cal costs about $125 a quarter. So maybe if it were the cost of now, more like $7,000 a year, I wouldn't have been so bold. But I was so angry. It was the first time I had felt an abuse of power. Because being a good student, getting straight A's, whatever, you're like, you're not getting in a conflict with authority or power, and the injustice of it, and really beginning to sort of understand racism in a different way. I think African Americans grow up understanding racism much earlier. For me, someone taunting me on the playground, you know, I was just taught to be tough and put my chin up. And so I was about to say earlier, it's like, sometimes people say you're not always as friendly as you should be. And it's like, when I'm under attack, I sort of do that thing. I find myself doing this thing that I did when I was 5 years on the playground. So it's like getting tough, putting my chin up, and just continuing to focus on work and what I have to do. So, but this, I just lost it. And I said, don't you ever bring my mother in. I don't care if you take away my scholarship. You have no right to do this.
What happened?
I walked out. Eventually did charge me during the Third World Strike and did take away my scholarship, even though John Vasconcelos and other people tried to help the Third World students. But to be honest, I just got a work-study job and, you know, barely missed it. And sometimes you have to be willing to make those sacrifices. So it, though, taught me to stand up, that whole sort of early years account. You know, I'm the kind of person who believes in institutional change. You know, the Kerner Report talked about there's racism of feelings and generations, and that may take us decades and a lot of heartfelt work with individuals. But the institutional racism, we can handle that. We can change the systems and make those little changes that give people more opportunities. So I've been pretty dedicated to that ever since we founded Ethnic Studies at Berkeley. So I don't care if it's in healthcare or as mayor, choosing a different way to hire police so that they're the most diverse in the city's history, or a different way of handling use of force. One of the things that right now is happening in Oakland is not only did we have that 6 weeks without a murder in Oakland, and, you know, some people say, oh, that's just a little decline. Well, excuse me. The murder rate in Jerry Brown's last year was 147. And if we get to 62, if somebody thinks that's just a little bit, then I don't know what planet they live on. And, you know, I'm the one who calls mothers when their children are killed, or visit them at children's hospital. Every violent crime in the city is personal to me. And for some people just to say, oh, well, crime's a little bit down, it's systematically down. That's what the difference is. And having couple thousand kids off the streets and working this summer played some role into that, because the gangs hide among the kids who have nothing to do, who are hanging out in playgrounds or just hanging out in the streets. And having young people at the end of summer come up to me and tell me what I'd heard a lot when I was a school board member, and we had the best school to career programs in the country, to tell me that they didn't know that these jobs existed, that they hadn't been out of their neighborhood, that it just changed their view of the world. And basically what they're saying to me is it broadened their dream. And a lot of what we're doing in Oakland is trying to give young people who live in neighborhoods where there's very little hope a dream, another opportunity. And that is a critical part of bringing down the violence. So it's not just the hiring of the police, but the work that I've been doing to help the schools, help the preschool programs, to save Head Start. Those things all together have brought the violent crime down. And again, for people who just dismiss that the progress we've made is nothing, it's sort of like they're cut back in 2 years ago and stats of 2 years ago, and are refusing to see. I mean, even the San Francisco Chronicle had an above the fold article saying that violent crime is plummeting in Oakland.
Do you credit Measure Y? I mean, obviously we're coming up to 10 years of, yes, Measure Y. It's up for re-election, much like you. Much like you.
I wrote Measure Y.
It also brought in ceasefire. It has all these different components.
Yes.
Do you credit Measure Y with helping to bring down? You know, I know that it's had issues in some of its implementation because of money, because of other things. But has it helped bring down the violence in Oakland?
I think, first of all, you had to look at Measure Y like anything that's complicated for social change. Some of the things worked and some of them didn't, and we adjusted as we went along. Same thing as my being mayor. I learned I could do some things, I couldn't do other things, and I think I've become a much better mayor. And it takes you have to take some chances. So I took some chances on things. Some of them worked. Most of them did, right? So we'll all be watching what happens at the Coliseum. You know, I took a chance that I thought that we should have something more than just sports teams out there, that we should have housing, whatever. And so that's maybe one of the biggest chances I've taken, you know, because if it goes wrong, then everyone's going to beat me up. But we'll be much farther ahead in development there no matter. Same thing with Measure Y. The programs that I think have made the biggest difference are this. We have street outreach workers. So whenever there's a gang violence incident in Oakland, we can put people on the street who know the neighborhoods, can talk to the kids, can mediate and bring that down. Now, in addition to that, I was able to get federal help from Eric Holdner. I made a special trip to Washington. I asked him for more federal agents because a lot of the gangs with the drugs and their gun connections are out of Oakland, and we need a much wider, and I was able to get that. And so that combination with the ceasefire program, and some people said, oh, well, I had a rough start. Yeah, because we didn't have enough money, and I used my own personal staff money and went out and got some additional grants. So now it's adequately funded, and it's making a real difference. And in the beginning, people were like, I don't know if we want to fund that, et cetera.
Well, because ceasefire wasn't even implemented until like
2 years ago.
Yeah, like and even then when it came in, it had all these hiccups. Was it the Chicago ceasefire? Was it the Boston ceasefire?
And I think we had to test it out. But what was critical, and then also, do we pay some nonprofits and churches? Do we not? And, you know, I said, people are dying. So I'm just going to start this. We're going to start it, and we're going to see what happens. I'm going to use my own staff person, Reagan Harmon, who is now the director, used to be my public safety person. We're just going to start it. I sent Reagan to different places. And I think we've learned a lot from the Richmond model, particularly in giving them incentives to keep going. Because, you know, thousands of people have been dropped in Oakland from prison, and they don't even have a GED. I mean, one of my things with Jerry Brown and with the state legislature, if you're going to spend as much money as it costs me to send my kids to Ivy League schools and keep them for about an average of 4 years, they should at least come out with a GED, because I had to use critical Measure Y money to try to keep them alive and with stipends and to keep them going until they get their GED, and then try to help them find a job. And so we have to work on a much wider level. The third thing that has been very important, and it doesn't get a lot of kudos for it, but our particularly focused programs to help girls get out of sexual exploitation, our sexual exploitation minor programs, which I've championed and I'm very proud of, and our funds for kids who are particularly emotionally and or otherwise scarred by violence, giving young people interns and jobs to find their voice. So youth radio, there's a group of youth radio kids.
We air their stories.
Who come from very tough situations. And this is sort of a sneaky way to teach them how to read and keep them going. And so many of those young people have a very low recidivism. So 80% of the young people who are touched by Measure Z programs do not go back to jail or do not get in trouble again. The state average is the opposite. 80% of the people who are released from prisons and from CYA, the juvenile facilities, do go back to prison. So, you know, I think the state should be doing more Measure Z programs, more preventative programs. It should be like almost an HMO, that you give me this money that it costs to lock up a kid, and I'll try to keep him out of jail, and I get to keep the difference so I can help more kids. I mean, that's sort of, there's a pilot program like that in Detroit. I've been trying to get the governor interested in that. I said, okay, cost you $160,000 a kid to lock them up for that amount of money. I can give them a good paying job. I can get them a counselor. You know, I can help send them to school, right, for $160,000 a kid. Give me that money. Let me take the lowest violence kids, because you're going to put them back on my street more damaged. You know, they're going to be more likely to come back drug addicted. They're more likely to come back more engaged with gangs after state prison. Give me the money up front, and, you know, I'll put them work. I'll give them jobs.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk on such a wide number of issues with us today.
Can I do my short opening statement? Because a lot of things we didn't hit on.
Yes, absolutely. Okay.
in most debates, we have this opening, so I'll combine my opening and
there were things we didn't hit on. Right, we hit on so much.
I just want people, you know, we've sent out our first mailing, 10 things that you may not know about Mayor Kwan. And I think so many things happen that people have forgotten what's happened. But, you know, I want to remind people, I came in at probably one of the worst times in California history to be a mayor, and particularly in the city. I came in with a debt that we didn't expect. Property taxes went down. And today, next week, I'm going to release our closing out the books from the fiscal year ending June 30th. We're going to be $26 million above in revenues. Now, don't get excited out there. Most of it is to pay for things that the city council approved but didn't have the funding for. So, and that will include things like some of the increased salary and benefits that we felt was fair to give the employees. And we had one-time money to pay for it, but now the rising tax base will be able to pay for it permanently and ongoing it. Also, another police academy. So that will be my 7th police academy. On Halloween, we will be at 720-something. That's about the level the police force was when I became a council member almost 12 years ago. And we have another class that's already started, and now I'm going to speeding up a third class. So that means by the end of the year, we should be like at 780, 790, very close to 800 of next year. And so I've been growing the police force. I've been investing in that because a safe city is an underpinning of growing the economy and building new homes that people want to live in a safe place. Thirdly, I've been able to get transformational projects going and to get the investments in them. So the Oakland Army base was stalled for over a decade. I was able to save and secure $250 million of state funds and get a private partner so that now we're looking at 2,000 to 3,000 construction jobs and 1,500 to 2,000 permanent good paying blue collar jobs, of which 50% of both have to go to Oakland residents. So that's a transformational project because it keeps Oakland one of the top ports in the country, the major port for exporting to Asia. And if you add that with the airport, it's a big part of our economy being the transportation center of Northern California. The second transformational project is when the banks didn't lend. If you remember when Obama was saying, we saved the banks, and now they are sitting on $7 trillion.
Right.
We had the fastest growing housing market. I mean, homes were not staying on the market longer than a week or two. And the banks would not lend to the buildings that were lined up and approved. And finally, I was able to get a Chinese investor, the largest still, I think, individual Chinese investment in the United States to put in $1.5 billion to get Brooklyn Basin started. And again, 25% of those construction jobs are going to be apprenticeships, so people have opportunity to get their union card and have long-term viability of good-paying blue-collar jobs. After that happened, suddenly the U.S. banks and other investors found us, and now 11,000 homes are in the pipeline. And that has never happened before. Lastly, I've talked about the police reform. No other mayor has taken on both the diversity of the hiring and the reform in the police department. The fact that we've gone 16 months now without an officer shooting at anyone is not an accident. We've changed the rules of pursuit. We've changed the rules to how you can chase someone. And we have changed how we draw our guns, under what conditions and what safeguards. And that, to me, is amazing. We cannot even find a time. The records only go back 20 years ago, that we hadn't find a time we went over a year without drawing our guns and shooting at a civilian. The average before the last 16 months has been 8 shootings a year. So I think we have a very solid and different police department. And lastly, I've been the president of the school board. I have been a national advocate for education. I know school reform and have been one of the strongest partners of as a mayor since Elihu Harris of the school district. And I plan to partner very closely with the schools, because until our young people have a different hope, we can't have 50% of our black and brown boys dropping out of school.
You know, so, and it's been that way for years.
It's been for decades, and that needs to be a citywide promise that all of us, the city, every resident, we need to take care of what I consider, and this will all end with, Martin Luther King, I was honored to be the guest of President Obama for the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech. But I've always known in the Vietnam speech and in that speech that the media never reports on the parts of economic justice. He ended that speech saying that across America, we have these islands of poverty and these oceans of prosperity. And that's how I feel about Oakland right now. I've got these pockets in East and Havens Court, Lockwood, and Acorn, Campbell Village areas where people have been trapped on these islands of poverty, and that's not okay anymore. We as a whole city, now that the city is rising, have to make sure that those neighborhoods come along and that those children have the same hopes and dreams as the kids in the rest of the city. And as mayor, I've done more to be in every neighborhood, to try to be the mayor, really, for the whole city. Nobody who's running against me has either had the presence or the campaign or the roots or the work in as many areas of the neighborhood of the city as I do. And I want an opportunity to finish that work. I want an opportunity to make sure that after the next 4 years, that those islands of poverty are gone, or at least fading quickly, and that every kid in the city has a real dream for a future. And so that's my opening and closing. Thank you.
Thank you so much.